My name is Keith Lewis, and I'm an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to be here again at the Midwinter Conference. And I just wanted to say that sponsorship has a lot to do with the second step. You know, recently I did a retreat in Tallahassee, Florida, and the theme of the retreat was that God always put the right person in your life at exactly the right time. And I believe that sincerely. And, you know, the two people who put my life early were my parents, and they were perfect gentlemen. My father was a perfect gentleman. My mother was just magnificent. And whenever a woman came to the table, and my father would stand. And he was incredible. And he was an amazing man. And, you know, in the this May, I'll have the privilege of celebrating 34 years. And I've had four sponsors since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor right now is John H. from Hilton Head. And I have another sponsor. And he's a little bear that sits on our rocking chair in our bedroom. It's called Sponsor Bear. And if you push his belly, he says things like, let go and let God, easy does it, and things like that. And he's magnificent, but he stopped talking to me. So I guess he figures that you're only supposed to have one sponsor, and that's John H. You know, when I was brand new, I came in May the 13th, 1973, and I was in the process of taking my own life in the basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. And the Blessed Virgin Mary saved my life. She really did. And she literally spoke to me, and my head cleared up, and I remembered I had a phone number, and I called it. And I went to a little treatment center. And they told me when I left the treatment center, Ernie R. started the treatment center. And they told me when I left the treatment center to get a sponsor. So there were two guys in Washington, D.C. that I admired a lot. Dan C. and his best friend. And, you know, I decided that I was going to, I know they went to a meeting. You know, the first 2 years I was sober, except when I was in Paris and in Rome. I went to 10 meetings a week. And that's very important, I think, to go to a lot of meetings if you're new. And so what happened was I figured, you know, that I was going to ask whoever walked in that door first. And Dan walked in the door first, and I asked him. And I'll tell you, what he did to me changed my life. So what he told me was, you know, the man who brought AA to Washington, D.C. was on his deathbed. And he's the man who went to the Library of Congress when they wrote the big book. And, you know, they were going to name it The Way Out. And he said that would be the 13th title. And so what happened was Dan took me to his deathbed. And I'm so selfish and self-centered because I'm brand new. And this man changed my life because he was absolutely thrilled that that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was in my 20s at the time. And he said to me, he said, I'm so happy you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Here's a man who's dying, and he's more concerned about me than he is about himself. He was an amazing man. He was a very wealthy young man when he got sober. Bill Wilson was his sponsor. And he built a chapel across from Georgetown University, where I had the privilege of going to school after I got sober. and they gave me a scholarship. But he built a little chapel over there, and in his will he said that if AA wanted to use that chapel, they had the first shot at it. He was an amazing man. And when I left there, I left in tears, because he was more concerned about me than he was about himself, and he's dying. And that taught me so much about Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he did an amazing thing with me. And then when I was sober about 3 months, I got a letter from the University of Paris Medical School from Dr. Jerome Lejeune, who, when he died, he was the Ethesian for, he was a brilliant man. He was the Ethesian for Pope John Paul II. And what happened was he invited me to Paris to study chromosomal banding, because when I got sober, I was supervising the genetics labs at Georgetown University Hospital. And I had figured sponsorship out. Sponsors figure out what you want to do, and they tell you you can't do it. And so I took the letter to Dan at lunchtime, and he beamed. He said to me, he said, you know, he said, you can do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous if you prepare properly. And so what happened was, he told me, he said, we have from now until January of 1974 for you to go to Paris. And he said, we're going to do the 12 steps. And we did the 12 steps. And back in those days, you did a lot of 12-step calls. And I'd do two or three a week. And they didn't have detoxes then. And so what happens, you know, you'd sit, three and four people would sit around the clock with people who were detoxing. And it was an amazing phenomenon. And so what happened was he got me ready to go to Paris. And when I got there, Dawn, who lives here on Hilton Head Island, had taken Alcoholics Anonymous to France. And he was an amazing man, and he had me lead a meeting over there. Anybody who came through town had to lead a meeting. And you know, when I got sober, when you introduced yourself, nobody said hi, you know. And so what happened was he asked me to lead the meeting. I'm holding a cup of coffee, and this woman from Idaho, I introduced myself, and she said, hi, Keith, and I dropped the coffee in my lap. So whenever I hear that, I get a warm feeling. So what happened was Don sponsored a man over there who took care of me, and he was an artist. And I used to go to his art studio in his where he lived. And he used to bring French drunks off the street, you know, and he would detoxify them in his art studio. And I would go down there at lunchtime, and I'd feed him soup, and I'd tell him my story. And he told me, he said, that's wonderful. And he gave me a painting that he had done, and I have it hanging in my den right now. And the other thing we have hanging in my den is my wife's, Julia's, gold badge. She was a chief probation officer in Wilmington. And she was always the right person put in my life. And, you know, she got so many people sober. Her state car, they used to call it the sober wagon. She used to drive people to my home group all the time. And she got so many people sober. She'd wait till they made a mistake, and she'd say, I can revoke you and send you to prison, or you can go to Alcoholics Anonymous and get a sponsor and bring them to meet me. And that's what she did. She got so many people sober. It was just amazing. And I had the privilege of speaking at the brew banquet down in Miami, and she went down with me, and we went down early, and we're walking through a rough part of town, and she looked nervous, and I put my arm around her, and I felt her 38 on her hip, and I felt better. But, you know, God always put exactly the right person in my life at exactly the right time. And, you know, when I was sober about 3 months, which is a very dangerous time in sobriety, Dan took me to meet a man who led a meeting at our home group, and his name was Happy Harold. He was an African-American man who was absolutely magnificent. He's still actively involved in AA up in D.C., and, you know, if you read AA Comes of Age on page 276, they talk about, you know, Bernard Smith, who was the first chairman of Alcoholics Anonymous. They talk about fellowship. And he quoted Canon C.E. Raven, who was a noted British religious leader. And he talked about what fellowship is all about. And one of the things is that people look at people and they know when they're in trouble in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was just, my head was running like crazy. And I'm walking by Happy Harold's table, and he reached out and took me by the arm, and he said, "Son, you look troubled." And I said, "I'm so filled with guilt, I hate myself." And he said, "You don't have a right to hate yourself because you're sober 3 months now." And he said, "I know all about guilt." And he told me a story that changed my life. He told me that, he said, my mom was dying in intensive care unit, and she called me up, and she said to me, "Son, I want you to come and see me, but don't be drunk because I don't want to go into eternity seeing my oldest boy drunk." And he shows up at the hospital the next morning and he's drunk. And I said, "You were?" And he said, "I didn't know, I hadn't met you people. I didn't know how not to be drunk." And so what happened was his brothers and sisters wouldn't let him go up. And so he called up and talked to his mother and he said, "Mom, can I come up and see you?" And she said, "Are you drinking?" And he said, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, "I don't want to see you drunk." And she died, and he didn't get to see her. And I said, "How do you live with that?" And he gave me a lesson which changed my life. He said the worst thing you do in your alcoholism will become your greatest gift. And so what happened was, you know, I'm working at Georgetown University Hospital, and I see him at the elevator, and we shook hands, and in those days you didn't hug, you just shook hands and looked each other in the eye. And so what happened was we talked for a few minutes, and then he left, and I turned around, and a nurse was standing there, and she said, "Harold's the finest man I know." And he said, you know, this is before hospice started in D.C., and he said, "Whenever we have somebody here who's dying in a hospital and they have no one in their family, we call Harold, and he comes and spends time with them and helps them die." And I was overwhelmed, and their words rang through my head. The worst thing you do becomes your greatest gift. And, you know, Dan did so many things for me. It was absolutely amazing. Again, my estranged wife, we were separated because she threw me out because I was drunk and I was falling asleep with cigarettes. We had two beautiful little girls, and she was afraid I'd burn the apartment down. And so what happened was she said to me, she came to my, you know, where I was living. I was still living in the basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., she came to me and she said, you know, she was so upset that she couldn't get me sober. But those strangers in Alcoholics Anonymous got me sober. And she was very upset about that. So she said to me, She said, I want you to come home and watch your little girls grow up. And I started to cry because that was the dream of my heart. And she said, I want you to stop going to those meetings. And I said to her, I said, I can't stop going to those meetings because if I do, I'll drink again. And so she turned around and walked out. And I called Dan and I explained to him what had happened. And he said to me, he said, you know, in 1961, when you joined the Marine Corps up in Pittsburgh, he said, you got drunk for the first time. And he said, you crossed an invisible line into alcoholism. He said, now you gave up the dream of your heart and you crossed an invisible line into sobriety. And he said, if you're willing to give up the dream of your heart to stay sober, he said, then, you know, that's everything you need to do. And so it was an amazing group of people who were in Washington, D.C. when I got sober. And one of them was Dick's sponsor. And when I was real new, Dan introduced me to him. His name was Buck Doyle. Buck's gone now. He was a flying tiger. He was an incredible man. And if you were new, you always had a bruise on your chest because when he talked to you, he poked you in the chest, you know. And I had no platelets, and you know, because I had been drinking so much. And so he said to me, he said, you know, son, your problem is that you have a spiritual illness. He said, you violated every tradition and every principle you've ever been taught as you grew up. And that was absolutely true. It was a spiritual illness. And when I saw him the next time, I said to him, I said, you put a bruise on my chest. He was a funny man, and he said, that's so that when you take a shower, you'll remember what I told you. He was an amazing man. And Dick and Peggy were amazing, too. They did incredible stuff in Washington, D.C. And so what the other thing that happened when I got, you know, after I went to Paris and studied with Dr. Jerome Lejeune, when I was on the airplane landing in Orly Airport, I'd been drunk in Paris numerous times when I was in the Marine Corps. But so here tears are running down my cheeks. And I'm sober about 7 months then. And I'm just amazed. And I'm walking the streets of Paris, a free man. And what happened was when I left there, I went to Rome. And I got to stay in a monastery for a few weeks. And I met a number of people in the American Embassy, the British Embassy, and the Australian Embassy. And there was only one Italian man who was sober in that group. And the name of the address of the group was 13 Vianapoli. And they only met on Wednesday. But what I would do is have lunch with these people just about every day so that I could maintain my sobriety and get all the information that I needed to get from the new, you know, the old timers. And my second sponsor was Sandy B. And Sandy spoke at the International down in New Orleans. And he was allowed to take one person up to the front with him, and he took me. And I was amazed. And Lois Wilson sat next to me and patted my hand and said, I'm so glad you're sober. And I said, me too. And the man who had, the Italian man, had translated the big book into Italian and gave her the very first copy. And it was an amazing situation. You know, when I got back from Rome, I was sober coming up on a year. And every Monday night, we would go to the intergroup office, Dan and I, and we would talk about things. And we'd answer the phone and, you know, call people to do 12-step calls and that sort of thing. And if somebody was in a hotel, we'd call somebody and get them to pick them up and take them to an AA meeting. And so he said to me, he said, how are you doing financially? And I said, I'm hopelessly in debt. He said, only the United States government is hopelessly in debt. And I laughed, and he said, I want you to do a budget. He said, you have to define your problem. That's what sponsors always told me. You have to define what your problem is. And so the next week, I did a budget, and I brought it to him. And I said to him, I said, I'm $100 a month in the hole. And he said, that's not bad. He said, we can rearrange your payments. And the next morning at 7 o'clock, a call from Ernie R., who had a DWI school out in Bethesda. And he said to me, he said, would you give a lecture every month on the effects of alcohol on the brain and the nervous system? And I said, I'd be glad to. He said, I'll pay you $25 a week. That was my $100. And then I go into school, and I mean into the hospital, and on my desk there's a note from the Paul Bruns, who was the chairman of the OBGYN department that I worked in. And he had the note said he wanted to see me, and I knew I was going to get fired. So I went up there, and the wage and price freeze was in effect. He said to me, he said, I'm so proud of what you've done in, with your life in the last year. And he said, I can't give you a raise because President Ford has put a wage and price freeze in effect. And he said, what I can do is give you this. And he gave me a scholarship to Georgetown University. And so I went down to my boss, Father Bone Miller, who just passed away in Cincinnati. He gave me all these chits for books, and I never bought a book while I was in the university. And then I get a call from the lady from the admissions office, and she said, I heard you got a scholarship. And I said, I did. And she said, I want you to know that, you know, I had given her brother a job in a laboratory because he wanted to go to Tufts Medical School, and he had to work in a laboratory for 3 months before he could go. And I gave him a job there. And she said, today President Ford is signing a bill that extends you Vietnam-era guys your education benefits. And so I went from $100 a month in a hole to $400 a month ahead. You know, always the right people were put in my life at exactly the right time. And then when Dan moved away from Washington, D.C., I got Sandy B. to be my sponsor. And Sandy is an incredible human being. And he took me through the steps. And he did a thing with me. He always insisted that you take action after the third step. And he told me when I did, I did a fourth and fifth step. He wouldn't hear my fifth step. He said, "You have a problem with authority, and I don't want you to lie to me." He said, "I want you to hear somebody else to hear your fifth step." And Ed C., who now lives down in Texas, heard my fifth step, and he gave me instructions. He said, "I want you to do exactly what the fifth step says." He said, go to a place where you experience God. And he said, tell God your fifth step. And so, you know, there's the chapel in Georgetown University Hospital was a place I'd gone to beg for my daughter Kimberly's life when she was dying. And she was premature by like 3 months. And I had given up on miracles because I was very sick at the time. And they were coincidences to me. They weren't miracles. What a coincidence. The chief resident on the neonatal nursery was a girl I'd gone to high school with back in Bel Air, Ohio, at St. John's. And what a coincidence. And she said to me, she said, we ordered the first negative respirator on the East Coast. It arrived 3 days ago. We put it together yesterday. We'd like to put your baby on it. What a coincidence. And Kimberly now lives up in Fairhope, Alabama. She has two beautiful little daughters. And, you know, and so I went back to that chapel where I had begged for her life, and I promised God I wouldn't drink. And I was drunk in 12 hours. That's before I met you folks. And so what happened was Blaise Pascal, one of my favorite philosophers, said God created man as his own, in his own image. Unfortunately, man returned the favor. You know, so I created a God who would kill a little girl because her dad was sick. That's not the God I serve today. And so what happened was I went to that chapel, and I did my fifth step before the tabernacle. And when I left there, I was in tears. And my life changed. And then he told me to, he said, the other thing it says to do is you tell yourself. And he told me to sit in front of a mirror. I put on a coat and tie before I went to the chapel to talk to God. And so then I put on a, you know, I went to, and sat in front of the mirror, you know, one of those big mirrors you practice your golf swings in front of. And so I sat there, and I told myself my fifth step. And then I went down to Ocean City, Maryland, and found Ed, and he heard my fifth step. And then when I came back to Sandy, I told him the stuff I had done. And he gave me action to take on 6 and 7. And the action he told me to take, he said, go to the 12 and 12 and look at the 7 deadly sins. And he said, get a good definition for each of the 7 deadly sins. And one of my favorite writers is Venerable Luis of Granada, who wrote a book called The Sinner's Guide. 10 publishers does it, and he has the best definitions. And he also gives you a lot of action to take to overcome these things. You know, number one was pride. And Sandy told me to, he said, write a good definition of each of the 7 deadly sins. And he gave me a little notebook to put in my shirt pocket. And he said, what I want you to do is, he said, you watch yourself. And he said, start off with pride, because pride heads the list. And he said, what I want you to do is I want you to work at these things. And he said, if, you know, and write it down whenever you see you're doing that. And so I spent a week on each one of these 7 deadly sins. And gluttony was not a problem for me, because my daughters asked me, when I got sober, they were 3 and 4. And 3 years later, I'm smoking in a car with them. We're going around the Beltway. And they said, Daddy, you have a right to kill yourself, but you don't have a right to kill 2 innocent little children. So I pulled off the Beltway and I said, okay, get out. And they laughed. You know? And so the next day I went to Sandy and I said to him, I said, I want to show my daughters that an adult can do anything. So what I did was I went there and I, he told me, he said, we have a perfect plan. He said, every morning at 7 o'clock, before you go to the treatment center, which I was running in Psychiatric Institute, he said, I want you to get on your knees and ask God to remove the desire of smoking. And he said, I want you to do that for 30 days. And he said, every morning at 7 o'clock, he worked for the government at the time, and he said, I'll pray for you every morning. And so we did that for 30 days. And on October the 15th, 1976, I had my last thing I smoked. I threw away 4 cartons of cigarettes. I threw away some Cuban cigars that a friend of mine had given me, who worked with the Russian embassy, and who I had 12-step. They also, I threw away pipe tobacco. I used to have pipe tobacco to deliver it every, and I had these hand-carved Meerschaum pipes from around the world, and I wrapped them up and sent them to my father. And so what happened was I haven't had anything to smoke from then till now. It's been over 30 years now. And to this day, my daughters tell me, an adult, you proved to me that an adult can do anything. And so what happened was, you know, Sandy always put a plan together for whatever problem I had. And he was an incredible guy. And then, you know, when I left Washington, D.C. in 1980, I went down to Fayetteville, North Carolina. I loved Fayetteville because every time I got shot at in the Marine Corps, the 82nd Airborne was around. I have a profound amount of respect for them. And so what happened was I opened a treatment center down there with my friend Ted C., who is now in a rest home. He was a psychiatrist. He was a wonderful man. I got to go to the Johnson Institute with him in 1974, and so what happened was he asked me to come down and do that, and D.C. was so crowded at the time, you know, you couldn't even get into a grocery store because there were no parking spaces. So I went down to Fayetteville, and I love Fayetteville a lot, and I love Wilmington, and I love North Carolina because that's where Julia grew up. And so what happened was I opened this treatment center, and I had a really bad feeling about these people that I worked for. And so what happened was I used to check the financial records of, I had 30 beds, and they were full. And I always checked the financial records of my patients. And I brought my good friend down, Bob Brown, who's gone now. And he was in the Navy for many, many years. And he was a great golfer. He was all Pacific. And he bought a house out there in Hope Mills. And he bought a house out there on a golf course. And he introduced me to golf. And so I'm out there, and this old man came up to me in a golf cart, and he said to me, he said, "You're a nice man. You help people." He said, "How would you like to learn to play golf?" I said, "I'd love to learn to play golf." And he said, "I'll teach you." He said, "But you cannot," he said, you have to practice, and you can never pay me." And so what happened was, it was Raymond Floyd's dad, L.B. Floyd. And he taught me to play golf. He was an incredible friend of mine. And I got to be the master of ceremony at his birthday parties. And he was a wonderful man. And once I sent him steaks from Kansas City, where I spoke at a conference out there, and he said to me, "You're trying to pay me." I said, "No, I'm trying to be your friend." And so, you know, the right person was always put in my life at exactly the right time. And so I discovered, I was sponsoring a man whose father had passed away 6 months before. And he had retired out of the Army, and he was on campus. And so what happened was I went to the medical, the financial records, and they're still billing Champus for this man. And they had billed a number of people who had died, who had committed suicide and things like that. They were still billing Champus for these guys. And so I called my sponsor, Sandy, and I told him what was going on. And Sandy said to me, he said, "You cannot live an immoral, you cannot affiliate with immoral people and expect to live a spiritual and sober life." And I said to him, you know, I grew up in poverty, so I was terrified. And I said, "I don't have another job." And he said, "You have a beach house." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Refinance it, pay all your bills, and get a six-month prudent reserve set aside and trust God." So that's what I did. And a month later, I'm at the beach house, and there's a knock on the beach house door, and the FBI were there. And they said to me, they asked me, they interviewed me like five times, and I was amazed. And in order to stay out of prison, these two guys had to pay back the money they had stolen from the government. They had to pay a fine, and they had to sell all their properties. And I had gotten them certificates of need and things like that. And so I get a call from Birmingham, Alabama, and the chairman of this hospital corporation asked me to come down and talk to him about the certificates of need and the properties that I had bought for them. And so I went down and had lunch with him. And it's amazing. After lunch, he said to me, he said, "Would you consider being a vice president in my corporation?" And I said, "I have experience, but I don't have that kind of experience." And he said, "You're the only man I ever talked to who came highly recommended by the FBI." It's always perfect, you know. If we will trust our sponsor, it's a big part of the second step. And if we will trust God, then things are going to work out for us. And, you know, the old-timers always taught me that sobriety is all about building character. You know, in Florida, there's so much profanity in AA meetings, it really bothers me. But I go to meetings anyway. I go to a lot of meetings anyway. But, you know, when I was real new, I used the S word in a meeting at a club. And the chairman said, "We don't use that language in Alcoholics Anonymous." And so I was so embarrassed. You know, I just sat there and my face was beet red. And when I left the meeting, after the meeting was over, this very elegant, tall British woman came up to me. She was in the British Embassy in D.C. And she said to me, she said, "May I ask you a personal question?" I said, "Of course." And she said, "Do you eat with the same mouth you talk with?" And, you know, it just amazed me. And I called Dan at the time, and I said to him what I had done. I said, "I'll never curse in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous again." He said, "Why would you curse anywhere?" He said, "Sobriety is all about building character." And so I started cleaning up my language. The Navy had taught me to curse when I, you know, I was aboard a lot of Navy ships. And they taught me a lot of words. And I'm just joking, of course. The Navy always took me nice places. Whenever I got on an Air Force plane, I got shot at. They weren't good to me at all. So, you know, that's what sobriety is all about. It's about cleaning up our language. It's about cleaning up our lives. It's about doing all this stuff. And, you know, Tom I was my sponsor in 1985 when I moved from Birmingham back to Fayetteville. That's when I met Julia. Julia was at an AA meeting in a hospital that I had opened that treatment center in. And she had driven 2 hours to bring a friend of hers over there to pick up her one-year chip. And Julia was an Al-Anon meeting. You know, was an Al-Anon member then. And so what happened was I had driven a friend of mine who had eye surgery. He was speaking. And Bob... And so we were both doing something for somebody else when we met. And so that was, it was magnificent. And then I asked Tom I to be my sponsor. And he drove over to my house from, he lived in the Pinehurst area. And he drove over to Fayetteville to my house. I had a really nice half a duplex on a golf course in Fayetteville. And he drove over, and we spent about 2 hours together. And he said to me, I said, "Do you want me to do another four-step?" And he said, "No, I want you to get somebody to sponsor." He said, "If you don't carry what you have to somebody else," he said, "you're going to suffer greatly." And so I went down to German Street, which is a club in Fayetteville, and a man walked in, and his eyes were that big, and I knew he was brand new. So I said to him, I said, "You need a sponsor." And he said, "Yes." And I said, "I'm your sponsor." His name was Michael. And Michael and I went through the 12 steps, and he made all his amends. He did a whole 10 yards, and he was sober about 12 years. And unfortunately, a man drove across the center line who was drunk and hit him head-on and killed him. But he had made amends to all his children, to his ex-wife, and all sorts of things. He had done a marvelous job. And I have his 12 and 12 at home. He had given it to me. He had left it at my house and before he died. And you know, that turned my life around. And, you know, I've sponsored probably about 100 people in the 33 and a half years I've been sober. And I sponsored a lot of people in prison, too. And that was incredible. And I take them through the steps in prison. I remember one time I'm on my knees with this guy and in a cell in prison. And we're praying the third step prayer. And he was shaking like crazy. And I said, "What's the problem?" And he said, you know, he said, "God may send me to Africa to be a missionary." And I said, "You know, you'd be better off in Africa than you would be in this prison." And he agreed with me. And so I took, you know, I took numerous people in prison through the 12 steps. And I have the privilege now of going into Marion Correctional Facility. And I also get to go to the centers and do a book study, which is the public treatment center in Marion County, and I've sponsored so many people over the years, and they've made a huge difference in my life. They really have. And you know, when I Tom did so much for me. He sponsored me for nearly 20 years, from 1985 to 2004. And then when I left Wilmington, we used to meet a lot. He would drive his motorcycle over after he retired. He worked in the prison system for years. And after he retired, he drove his motorcycle over, and we would meet for lunch, and we would spend 4 or 5 hours together. And one of the things I used to do with him was I would go through what I told the guys I sponsored. And if I had made a mistake, he would correct me. Because, you know, he's coming up on 50 years the 2nd of February. And so he's sober a long, long time, and he's done so much good for so many people. And so what happened was... when I left to go to Ocala, Florida, to open a psychiatric hospital, he said to me, he said, "You have to be near somebody you can talk to." And so I got John H. to be my sponsor. And, you know, I opened that hospital, got a license, got it through JACO and did all that stuff. And I hadn't failed at anything. But the biggest problem I had was that... it was the oddest organization I ever worked in my life. And I take John's advice. And I was struggling big time with stress-related depression. And recently I had a stroke. And that's why I write stuff down. So I don't forget. But, you know, John told me to resign. So I did what he told me to do. And I had three doctors tell me the same thing. They said, if you don't resign with that depression, you're either going to end up with diabetes with your family history, or you're going to end up with heart disease. Because there's a tremendous amount of diabetes and heart disease in my family. And so I explained that to John, and John told me, he said, hang it up. And so I've been able to consult with numerous people around the country. And Westover Consultants from Bethesda, Maryland, called me up and asked me to head up a team of therapists. And we went up to Lafayette, Louisiana. And I got to work. I had five people on my team, and we worked with 400 Katrina victims. And many of them were dying of stress-related depression. Many of them were suicidal, and many of them were had post-traumatic stress disorder. And we got to work with them. And it was an amazing phenomenon. It really was. And I got John's permission to go do that, because I don't do anything that I don't get the permission of my sponsor to go do it. And I also have a spiritual advisor, my pastor, Father O'Doherty, at Our Lady Queen of Peace Church on Route 200. We always call him the bishop of Route 200, but he's not. But he's a funny man. He really is. And he, too, is in recovery. And he's from Ireland, which means he's in big trouble. Most of my relatives are from Ireland. And, you know, one of the things I was able to explain to my sisters, and I cleared this with Dan before I did it. You know, I was supervising the genetics labs, and after I got sober, I looked into the genetics of alcoholism, and I went back and explained to my sisters that, you know, we had three of my four grandparents were alcoholic. So I explained to them that their chances were 60% that they would get into trouble if they picked up a drink or a drug. And neither of them drink. And they're in their late 40s now. And so it's a marvelous thing. And, you know, I also got to tithe some of my time out on the Navajo in Utah. And I would explain that to the parents of the Native Americans. And, you know, if you have these genes, the number one killer among the Native Americans was bad food. But if you have these genes, your liver swells and you effectively strain your bloodstream. And so if you have these genes, you don't die from food poisoning. And, you know, for thousands of years, they didn't have alcohol in their system. And so what happened was I got to spend some time out there. And the reason I got to spend some time out there was because, you know, when I came in, this young lady walked up to me, and she said, "How old are you?" I said, "I'm 29 years old." She said, "I'm 26. She said, "You're the fifth person to come into AA under the age of 30. So we hung out together, and we hung out with Peggy, and she was incredible with us. And so what happened was that year in 1973, nine of us came in to Alcoholics Anonymous. And this past December, the ninth one celebrated 33 years. It's an amazing phenomenon. It's because we all went to so many meetings, and we all had great sponsors and all that stuff. Peggy sponsored a couple of these ladies, and you know, she did an incredible job with them. And so everything that's happened to me has been perfect. And you know, I'm so thrilled to have John as my sponsor now, because he has given me nothing but good advice. And I want to take on another project before I'm done, you know, because I'm only 63 years old. I'll be 64 this year. But I want to take on one more project and do something to help people, because that's what it's all about. You know, every day when I'm at home, I go to our Adoration Chapel at Queen of Peace, and I pray for an hour. And I pray for the new members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I pray for the guys I sponsor, and I pray for my sponsor, And I pray for a lot of people and my brothers and sisters who are very sick. And two of them are sick with diabetes, and one had a uterine cancer surgery at the University of Ohio, at Ohio State Hospital out in Plumas. And she's doing beautifully. And my brother Leonard is losing his eyesight because he worked in a steel mill for too many years. I worked in a steel mill 2 months, but I was so drunk that I left. Yeah, I was lucky. So I want to tell you that it's an honor to be here at the Midwinter Conference. And it's an honor to be here with John and my wife, Julia. And I want to thank you very much for your time.